Good afternoon. Illinois Appellate Court, First District Court is now in session. The Sixth Division, the Honorable Justice Mary L. Mickford presiding, case number 21-0774, Daryl Miller versus George Guy.
Thank you, Darren. Welcome, gentlemen. As you probably both know, we generally allocate 20 minutes per side. When you introduced yourself, appellant, I will ask you if you want to reserve any of that time for rebuttal. We are somewhat liberal, and if you're in the middle of an argument, and we will give you a little leniency. Please, before we start the time running, would the attorney first for the appellant and then for the appellee introduce yourself and tell us who you represent and whether you want to reserve any time?
Okay, good afternoon, Your Honors. Jeffrey Esser representing Daryl Miller, who is the appellant in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Esser. And would you like to reserve time for rebuttal?
Yes, please.
How much?
5 minutes would be fine.
Okay, thank you. Counsel?
Good afternoon. My name is Christopher Heary on behalf of FLE George Guy.
Okay. All right, Mr. Esser, whenever you are ready, you may begin.
Okay. Good afternoon, and may it please the court. I believe that this case presents the question, is there ever a situation that the Illinois legislature can repeal a statute of limitations that does not run afoul of the Illinois Constitution? The facts of this case, just to set it in brief, my client is a 60-year-old man. The respondent is an 80-year-old man. He filed a petition to have the respondent found to be his legal father. Under the law previously, the Illinois Parentage Act of 1984, he would have been time barred bringing this case. According to the 1984 Act, he had to bring his case within 2 years of turning 18. In 2015, the Illinois legislature repealed the Illinois Parentage Act of 1984 and replaced it with the Illinois Parentage Act of 2015. That 2015 law did many things, but relevant for this matter, number one, it repealed the statute of limitations and said that a parentage action filed by an adult would no longer have any time bar as to when it could be brought. And then the second thing that it did is that it said that any actions that were previously time barred could now proceed. So that's what the legislature said. So my client, taking advantage of the new law, filed his action for parentage. The respondent in that case then said, filed a motion saying that that repeal of the statute of limitations was unconstitutional.
And the circuit court agreed.
And that's why we're here today. So the line of cases, as you read in my brief, it's a line of cases that spans about 130 years that respondent is correct that these cases say that once a statute of limitations has elapsed, that the legislature is not allowed to go back and revive them. And it says that in reviving them, that they would run afoul of the due process clause of the Illinois Constitution. That the Illinois Due Process Clause is very simple. It says, just like the federal one, that no one can be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. So I guess let me say it this way. The Illinois legislature was clear that it wanted the statute of limitations repealed. So I think that we have to find a reason, if it exists at all, to give the legislative enactment its due, right? And so I believe that the way to get there is to say that this is constitutional because this law would not deprive the respondent of life, liberty, or property. All the other...
Counsel, the cases that, the long line of cases that the trial court relied on and that your opposing counsel relies on, define property in a very broad way, all valuable interests that need not be visible or tangible. So how do you draw the distinction that you do between tangible property and the right to be free of acknowledging a son that you don't want to acknowledge, for example? How do you draw that distinction?
So I don't know if there's a great way to draw it, except to say that those cases never seem to go as far as to say that vested right to immunity is a property interest. Those cases seem to say that because it's vested, it can't be taken away. And I do agree, they are, the cases say all types of, you know, actions whatsoever, right? But I guess I would submit to the court, it's like a fish not knowing that it's swimming in water. 99.9% of legal cases involve money, they involve property rights, they involve, you know, criminal law, which is taking away freedom. You know, did the court in 1895 think about a parentage act, a lawsuit that would declare somebody the parent of somebody else?
Well, the argument you're making wouldn't apply only to parentage acts. So it would also apply to any declaratory action that didn't specifically seek parentage, correct?
I think that would be right. Yeah, that it would not, there would be no constitutional bar to eliminating a statute of limitations so long as that taking away of the immunity doesn't impact a property right or a life or liberty right.
Yeah, but we're not talking about life or liberty.
We're talking about property, yes.
Right. Let me ask you a different question, and this seems to have been not considered directly by the trial court or by you, but is there an argument to be made that the fact that your client actually never had a chance to bring that claim, because by the time the 84 Act was enacted, he was already beyond the statute of limitations, and the only way he could have brought this claim was under an equitable extension of that 1984 Act that perhaps would have given him a two-year window to bring it up. Does that matter? Is that anything that distinguishes your case from the slide of cases that the trial court relied on?
I mean, I'm not sure that it necessarily would. I would have to go back and take a look. I think it was, there was a 65 Act that preceded the 84 Act. I may have that wrong, but I don't believe that.
But whatever.
Yeah. And I don't believe that act gave a right to adults at all to establish parentage.
That's correct.
So he, in essence, would never have been able to do it. Does that make a difference? Narrowly in this case, like we said, there's the vested rights line of cases, and all these, you know, the black and white reading of these is that it wouldn't, that he would be time barred because once that right vests, the Illinois legislature can never take it away. I say in my brief, I think that they're missing one logical step, and that's the question of, does taking it away imperil property? And if it doesn't, you know, then it can be taken away without offending the Constitution.
But doesn't the establishment of parentage also bring along with it other benefits to your client? A right to perhaps, you know, inheritance and things of that sort?
So I think, Justice Johnson, that would be absolutely correct. Of course, Mr. Guy would have total control over whether he wanted to disinherit the child by just writing him out of the will, quote unquote. I guess if he were to
die intestate, for example.
Die intestate. I don't know. I'm 99% sure that he's not going to die intestate, but maybe, right? I have no idea what his estate planning situation is. But yes, I mean, that would be the only way that he could get any property, because he cannot get child support. He can't get back child support. He can't get any type of monetary value from Mr. Guy whatsoever. And, you know, I mean, candidly, he's doing this because his father is a worldwide celebrity, and, you know, he would like his natural father to be his legal father. And I didn't put this in my brief, but, you know, I think that the creator of our universe would consider Mr. Guy to be Mr. Miller's father. And you know, if the laws of man prohibit that, I think that there is a problem there. But the federal constitution has, and I looked into this, it does not give you a fundamental right to know who your parents are. You can have blind adoptions, and a child does not get to, there is no fundamental right that has been articulated to this point that you have a right to have someone declared as your father.
Mr. Esser, your argument is really based on a distinction between those claims that seek money damages, you know, the Archdiocese case and all the other cases, and a case like this, which does not seek money damages. Isn't there some pecuniary value to having an immunity as a defense?
In the sense that he may, for example,
cost of defense, for example.
Yeah, cost of defense. I think absolutely that argument could be made. On the other hand, like, you know, I don't know that that's necessarily what the line of these vested cases, you know, are trying to protect. They're trying to protect the immunity against a lawsuit, not the cost of having to defend yourself. And on the other hand, I mean, why don't we say, like, you know, why defend yourself at all? If you know that this is your son, just agree to it. It doesn't have to be defended.
Is there anything else that you want to say in your opening argument?
I mean, no, because it's as counsel said in his reply brief, it is a very narrow issue. Either I think that this court holds that once a vested right to immunity is in place, that protects for all time, or in a case like this where no property is imperiled, it doesn't offend the Constitution. And on this very narrow ground, it could proceed. I think that's the only issue in this case.
Oh, thank you. Counsel.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Again, my name is Christopher Heary on behalf of Appellee George Guy. This court should affirm the trial court's determination that the retroactive application of the 2015 Illinois Parentage Act deprives Guy of a protected due process right, barring Miller's instant paternity claim based on its lack of timeliness. The issue submitted for this court's determination is narrow and has been clearly solidified by a century of Illinois Supreme Court jurisprudence. In Board of Education of Normal versus Blodgett, the Illinois Supreme Court first articulated the now constitutional principle that once a claim is time barred, it cannot be revived through subsequent legislative action without offending the rights protected by the Due Process Clause of the Illinois Constitution.
Counsel, I'm going to ask you the same question I asked Mr. Esser. In all of those cases, I believe that there was a statute of limitations. The statute of limitations was in place, and the plaintiff allowed that statute to run. At the end of that statute, the defendant knew, theoretically, and this is the theory, the defendant knew the statute had run, I'm clear, I'm done with this claim. And so the court said, well, it's unconstitutional to take that right to be free of that claim away from the defendant. But in this case, there was no statute of limitations that actually ran on this plaintiff. The 1958 statute was unconstitutional, so we can't rely on that one. So you're relying on the 84 statute, which ran before he would have ever had a chance to bring that claim. Your argument is that theoretically he could have brought it in 2 years after the 1984 statute, but that's different. That's a theoretical end to a statute of limitations. It's not an actual end to a statute of limitations. So I'm just wondering if, why you don't think that's different.
Thank you, Justice Mikva. So initially, I'd like to highlight that Miller has agreed in the trial court and agrees before this court that he was subject to the 1984 Parentage Act. And we address this issue in our brief on page 4 and footnote number 1. So as you highlighted, the Illinois Parentage Act of 1958 was deemed unconstitutional based on the statute of limitations that required paternity claims to be filed within 2 years after the birth of a child. And that was held by the U.S. Supreme Court in Pickett versus Brown. So after the legislature enacted the 1984 Parentage Act, and put in place the at-issue statute of limitations, which is based on majority plus 2 years. So courts interpreting the timeliness of parentage actions, which could have been brought under the Illinois Parentage Act of 1958, have used the Parentage Act of 1984 in terms of determining when the statute of limitations would have run on a claim would have run on their claim. So for instance, Miller was born in 1960. So giving generous effect to the statute of limitations from the 1984 version, his claim would have been time barred utilizing the 1984 version in 1986. Miller would have been 26 years old at that juncture.
I understand that that's the theory, and I understand that that's what happened. I'm just asking if the premise of this constitutional argument is the defendant, and it's a somewhat fictional premise, the defendant is looking at the claims, looking at the statute of limitations, he goes, phew, statute ran, I'm clear, I'm done. And this, our courts are saying, well, that's a vested right. He knows he's clear, he's done. But here, it's kind of fuzzy when the statute of limitations even ran. And you're saying 2 years, but it could be less. It's a reasonable time. It's not this clear, bright light that says to the defendant, you're clear to go. And I'm asking if that makes any difference.
Well, I do think it does make a difference. But courts interpreting when parentage actions are time barred under the 1984 Parentage Act have utilized that act statute of limitations in applying it to claims that could have been brought under the 1958 statute of limitations, but obviously that was deemed unconstitutional. So there are several cases that we list where they're applying the 1984 version. So the age of majority of 18 plus 2 years would be 20 under the 1984 version. And Miller was 26 at this juncture.
Okay. I understand it, that in your view, it's been pretty much waived by the plaintiff, but he certainly isn't precedent. I'm just saying it's a little troubling to me. Or it seems like a distinction, at least, that I wish had been more fully addressed by the plaintiff. But you can go on and address the constitutional claim, which...
Thank you, Justice.
Which was fully addressed, okay.
So specifically addressing Miller's challenge involves determining the nature of the vested right an individual obtains at the lapsing of a statute of limitations. Miller suggests that the due process right is only obtained when the underlying suit involves tangible property. Blodgett recognized that when a statute of limitation lapses, the putative defendant obtains a vested property right to invoke an immunity from suit. Justice Mikva, now you previously asked questions about this, and this is where the immunity from suit comes into play. Blodgett held that the immunity from suit is an intangible property interest recognized as a property right subject to due process protections. This intangible property right has no bearing on the tangible nature of the recovery sought in a legislatively resurrected suit, as Miller asked this court to find. The Illinois Supreme Court.
All the examples in Blodgett involved tangible property, money demands, real or personal property, or recovery of damages in tort. Blodgett doesn't give any examples of intangible property.
Justice Johnson, that is correct. But in 1968, the Illinois Supreme Court in Country Mutual Insurance versus Knight further affirmed Blodgett and said that a right is vested at the lapsing of a statute of limitations, and I emphasize, regardless of the nature of the cause of action. Miller contends that the Illinois Supreme Court jurisprudence should be disregarded and invites this court to engage in a forward-looking analysis, focusing on the tangible nature of the resurrected cause of action. However, this vested right is obtained back at the lapsing of a statute of limitations of the underlying claim and does not depend on the tangibility of what is sought in a potential future claim. Justice Johnson, as you highlighted, this was first determined in Blodgett. As the court stated, it's immaterial whether the action is for recovery of real property, real or personal property, recovery for money demand, or for the recovery of demand and tort, which was further expanded in Country Mutual Insurance versus Knight to include any claim, regardless of the nature of the cause of action. So based on
Mr. Heary, just to clarify for my own benefit, your position is that the court should not look at the nature of the plaintiff's claim for purposes of determining whether the due process clauses protection relating to property rights is at stake. Rather, we should look at the immunity, which is the limitations period lapse here. Is that your position, correct?
That is accurate. And that is what Blodgett and its progeny have held in terms of when the lapsing of the statute of limitations occurs, the putative defendant obtains a intangible property right at that juncture.
And so there's no case law directly on point. Are there any cases outside of Illinois that you may have come across on this subject? I know it's not addressed in the brief, but just curious.
I'm not aware of any, Justice. Okay. So based on this Illinois Supreme Court precedent, the trial court properly held that Guy obtained a vested due process right when Miller did not file a paternity action utilizing the 1984 Parentage Act, which he acknowledged he failed to do. Miller further agreed in the trial court, as he did before, it does before this court, that he was time barred from filing at the lapsing of a statute of limitations contained in the 1984 Parentage Act. Thus, once Miller's claim was time barred, the Guy was vested with a protected due process right, which was beyond legislative interference. Now, it was exactly this legislative tinkering with the 2015 Parentage Act statute of limitations and savings provision, which permitted Miller's previously time-barred claim to be revived, permitting him to file the at-issue paternity action. The 2015 Parentage Act's explicit permission to file a time-barred claim affronts Guy's vested due process right to invoke an immunity from suit. Now, this value of an immunity from suit was discussed by the Illinois Supreme Court in Doe versus Diocese of Dallas. And I would mention it's from 2009. So following Blodgett's progeny in 2009, recently the Supreme Court held this. In Doe, the plaintiff filed a sexual assault claim utilizing a 2003 expanded version of the statute of limitations, which permitted retroactive application to file her claim. So under the previous version of the statute from 1994, her claim was time barred. The defendant Priest moved to dismiss the plaintiff's claim, asserting that the action was time barred under the previous version, the 1994 version, and argued that applying the expanded 2003 version violated his due process rights. Under these facts, the Doe Court reaffirmed the legal principle that once a claim is time barred, it cannot be revived by subsequent legislative action without offending the defendant Priest's due process rights. The Illinois Supreme Court affirmed the trial court's dismissal of the claim as being time barred. The Doe Court holding compels the same result here. As agreed by Miller, he did not file a paternity action under the 1984 Parentage Act, and he's time barred from doing so pursuant to its statute of limitations. At this point,
Mr. Heary, can I want to just press you on this a little bit. Mr. Esser really argues that the due process clause is not even implicated here because all his client is seeking is a determination of parentage, which is basically, law of biology and science and natural law, I suppose. And that's all it is, that he's my father and that should be known for posterity's sake, at the very least. And I think you would agree that if Buddy Guy did not want anyone to share in his inheritance, he could arrange for that. Why is the due process clause at stake here? In terms of property, it's hard to sort of equate property to a determination that this man is my father.
Justice, I can answer that question in two parts. And first, specifically addressing your question, is the due process right that's implicated is the lapsing of Miller's statute of limitations, which vested the intangible property right with Guy. The second part of my question, speaking more broadly to the parental aspect, so if the object of a paternity action is to foster a parent-child relationship, that can be accomplished without a legal determination, especially where monetary support is mooted by the age of the parties, which is the case here. So there is a remedy outside the law for a parent-child relationship, but that's up to the individuals. And although, justices, this is not in the record, I will submit that Miller and Guy did have a relationship as a child and as adults before Miller filed this instant parentage action. The same can't be said for other Illinois Supreme Court cases where courts have struck plaintiff's only remedy based on the running of a statute of limitations, which protects the due process rights of the putative defendant. And in those cases—
Let me ask you this, maybe state the question differently. Is there a property right in not having a determination that you are someone's father?
To clarify the question, Justice, in a legal determination?
Yes, a determination by a court.
Well, I would go back to that there is a parentage act under 2015 and 1984. And when, based on Supreme Court precedent, when those, the time for claims under the 1984 Parentage Act lapse, I would again submit that is the vesting of the intangible property right. So it's not a physical property right that a putative defendant obtains. It's the intangible property right that's discussed for a century that an individual obtains. I hope that answers your question, Justice.
Thank you. You can proceed.
So the consequence of Guy obtaining this immunity from suit at the lapsing of a statute of limitations was discussed by the Illinois Supreme Court in Settmeyer versus Holman, which reaffirmed that an immunity from suit, which arises by operation of a statute of limitations, is a valuable right. and which is as valuable as the right that plaintiff has and maintains to bring the suit in and of itself. The Stettmeyer Court's consideration of value is narrowly relegated to the intangible right to raise a defense of immunity from suit. And it also correlates this value to plaintiff's right initially to pursue a claim. This intangible right possessed by individuals does not consider the tangible nature of the recovery sought. As plainly articulated by the Illinois Supreme Court in MEH versus LH, if a claim is time barred under an old law, a claim remains time barred under the new law. And also for the purposes of addressing all of Miller's contentions in his brief, the U.S. Constitution's taking clause case cited by Miller has no application to a determination of Illinois' due process protections. Plainly, the Miller court did not find a regulatory taking, and thus a compensation wasn't required to be paid the petitioner. The Miller court did not contemplate vested due process rights under the U.S. Constitution. Nonetheless, Illinois' Constitution, which accords broader protections of individual due process rights. In closing, we ask this court to affirm the trial court's finding that Guy obtained a vested due process right beyond legislative interference at the lapsing of Miller's prior ability to bring a parentage action. And I'm certainly happy to address any questions this panel may have in the remainder of my allotted time.
Any remaining questions from the panel?
No.
You're good. Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you.
Mr. Esser.
Yes, by way of rebuttal, so I think that there was some blurring of the lines between whether an intangible right is a property right. There are many vested rights that people have that are not, that you would not, should not be considered property for purposes of the due process clause. The right to free speech is not a property right. So to go on, like, not all intangible rights that can't be valued, that can't be defined, that can't be, you know, grasped in the hand, these I don't think are protected by the due process clause, which only protects against life, liberty, and property. And so, yes, this line of cases gives a vested right to Mr. Guy to be immune from suit. Taking that away, taking away his intangible right, is not the same as taking away a property right. I think where, you know, all of those cases got confused was that all of those cases that were cited, MEH, the Doe A case, Blodgett, these all would have opened up someone to a deprivation of property. And without that deprivation of property, you can take away the vested right without offending the Constitution. So that was my conclusion for my rebuttal. Any questions from the panel?
Anyone? Okay, both of you, thank you very much. It's a really interesting case.
Yeah. Okay.
We both agree.
And really interesting.
Your advisement, and you will hear from us shortly. Thank you.